This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, conserving mountain gorillas in Rwanda. Our guests are ecologists Bill Weber and Amy Vetter. Weber and Vetter began studying gorillas in Rwanda in 1978 with Diane Fossey. Ultimately, they worked with Rwandan authorities to create a program combining research, education, and ecotourism. The Mountain Gorilla Project, taking into account the need to protect wildlife while also respecting and making an effort to meet the needs of humans. The conservation effort has been a success, but in the wake of the genocide of 1994, Rwanda continues to suffer. Also, AIDS has taken a heavy toll. Weber and Vetter will talk with us this afternoon about the fragility of human and animal life and the conservation program they founded, the Mountain Gorilla Project. At the urging of friends, Amy Vetter and Bill Weber have written a book about their experiences with mountain gorillas in Africa. The title of the book, In the Kingdom of Gorillas, Fragile Species in a Dangerous Land. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Amy Vetter, Bill Weber, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Nice to talk with you. Hi. It was during your time in the Peace Corps in the mid-70s that your interest in the mountain gorillas began. Each of us, would you tell us about your first encounter personally with mountain gorillas and the people who study them? Who wants to start?
Oh, I'd be happy.
Okay.
When we were Peace Corps volunteers in what was then called Zaire, now called Congo, we were teaching high school, secondary school there, and we're located very close to one of the national parks in the country, so we had the occasion to go out several times and into the park. And we were escorted by the Belgian warden of the park. The first time we went out with the hopes of seeing gorillas, it was very early on in their program of trying to begin a tourism program centered around gorillas. And so the viewing that people had was very, very quick, just glimpses. But we were incredibly excited about going out. And we wandered up the mountainsides and through bamboo and difficult areas. We wandered into driver ant colonies so that some people actually had to strip off their clothes to get rid of these biting ants all over their bodies. It was really quite a remarkable experience overall. But when we got to see the gorillas that first time, the warden was right in front of me. I happened to be the first one in line in the group of about six of us. And he turned around and saw this young woman, American woman, behind him and told me that the gorillas were right ahead and pointed ahead at this huge silverback that you could just, adult male, you could barely see parts of. And turned to me and said, you know, you can go closer, I think, assuming that I would be scared to death and, you know, how would this woman react? And so I took it at face value and began crawling towards this massive gorilla about 10, 15 yards away. And he grabbed my pants and pulled me back. You can't do that. But it was, you know, we were fascinated from day one. They are amazing creatures. And somehow we had, I think both of us had grown up feeling that animals were very wonderful, that there are relationships that we have with them, and we trusted them. And so in my total naivete, you know, I trusted this adult male gorilla and was ready to go right up.
Bill, what's your clearest memory of that particular occasion?
Amy's actually talking about a visit to what are called eastern lowland gorillas, even though they live in mountains in eastern Congo. The next time after our time in Peace Corps that we saw mountain gorillas was when we went back with a grant from the Wildlife Conservation Society to actually try and study the habitat needs, the survival requirements of mountain gorillas in Rwanda at the camp that Diane Fossey founded. And so the experience was very different. Our first day there was going out to see a group of gorillas that had been studied off and on for a few years. So they were quite habituated to a human presence, and we practically stumbled over some of the gorillas when we went out on the trail the first day, just sitting there contentedly eating away, probably on wild celery, although we wouldn't have recognized any of these foods at first. And we sat down amongst them only a few meters away, and within a couple minutes, a young female named Quayle came up to Amy and ran her finger inside the cuff of her pants, and then sort of looked away shyly and did this kind of helicopter spin back down a little hill to sit closer to her mom. Just an incredible experience, again, to look into gorilla's eyes from that close, to be that close, to be accepted by them is an amazing experience.
Yeah. Now, the two of you come from different disciplines. Listeners, Amy studied biology in college, and Bill studied social sciences, and both of these things came together for this couple very powerfully and very effectively. Bill and Amy, would you talk with us about when and how you realized that it made sense to put your two backgrounds together for wildlife conservation?
I think initially probably my background kept us out of the Peace Corps program that dealt specifically with conservation at that time, run by, partly by the Peace Corps and the Smithsonian program, because I didn't have a biology degree. And in a way, that was great. It let us go off, be teachers. We learned a lot about Africa. You know, we improved our French. We learned Swahili. I think it gave us, we both believe, it gave us a great background for later doing conservation. But at the same time, it also gave us the opportunity to travel around Africa, not just in the gorilla park Amy mentioned in Congo, but we had some summertime free in Kenya and Tanzania. Traveling around, it became clear that what everyone knows, Africa has remarkable wildlife, incredible natural areas, spectacular landscapes, but all of this exists in a sea of poverty. And you know, one of our nagging questions was, how are you going to save all this given what local people seem to need and their perceived needs, often from within the same areas we're using the wildlife? How do we come up with a rationale that's an African rationale for saving wildlife? So when we came back, Amy had the biology background. She went on in graduate school to a PhD in biology with a conservation focus. But I went into an interdisciplinary program at the University of Wisconsin that allowed me to fill in some pretty big holes in tropical ecology in my background, but also take resource economics, African history, anthropology, et cetera. And it was, again, extremely helpful when we finally put all this together, looking at both the gorilla's needs and the needs of the people living around the gorilla park. Yeah, the Parc des Volcans in Rwanda, where we worked.
Yeah, now, at the time, though, that wasn't the way wildlife conservation was approached. Amy, did this multidisciplinary approach that you and Bill were proposing, did it meet resistance?
Well, I think it surprised people at the time. It was very interesting because I think when people heard that there was this couple working on gorillas, they assumed that the man and the couple was going to be doing the harder science. You know, he must be the ecologist, and the woman would be somehow interested in social behavior of gorillas or social events around, you know, with people. And, in fact, we were the opposite. And my expertise was accepted quite quickly, whether it was at a university setting in the United States or in a place like Rwanda. And, you know, people understood the essential nature of knowing about the basic requirements for resources for these animals. What I think surprised everyone was that Bill was looking at it in a very different way, a way, as you said, people had not done previously. And yet as soon as they began to think about it and work with him on it, I think everyone realized how essential that was. And in fact, I think the Rwandans we worked with in government and outside saw that very, very quickly and recognized they knew that it wasn't a standard approach to conservation, but it made such sense to them, and it was the only way to think about it in their midst that that was the innovative part of it, and it, I think, was the major key to our success.
Now,
yeah, a couple things, though, just to add on what Amy said, to remember. One, this is the late 70s.
Right.
So now a lot of these things are accepted, that you will do this kind of work, you will work with local people. And I appreciate Amy giving me credit for this, but even her work on applied biology, that's also a given now. But at that time, in the mid to late 70s, almost all of the work on primates in Africa was behavioral research, and not that much had the applied focus that she was taking, looking at gorillas' feeding requirements, habitat needs, movements around a protected area. So it was a different kind of project for those that time.
Hmm. When you began your work in 1978, what were your goals?
Our initial proposal to do our, when we looked for funding, outside funding for our work, the initial proposal was to, was even at that time, established to get better information, both biological and the socioeconomic, and to be able to apply it quickly to pilot activities that would help make a difference for conservation of gorillas in Rwanda. So right from the outset, this was our goal. We had lived in Africa long enough to feel that we really wanted to help make a difference and do that as efficiently and effectively as possible. So it was this combination of good science and providing information, as well as simultaneously pretty much moving into active steps.
You know, we've been talking about Rwanda, but the mountain gorillas inhabit more than one country in that part of Africa. Their grounds include Uganda and Congo. Mm-hmm. And in terms of wildlife conservation and management, what kind of relations exist between these nations?
They've varied over the years, and that's one of the things that makes any kind of transboundary conservation very complicated. Early on, I would say the relations were neither good nor bad. They were simply non-existent. The countries shared this chain of volcanoes, but they barely acknowledged each other's presence. Once we began a successful conservation program, the Mountain Gorilla Project that came out of our applied research, we then stayed and worked with others in a consortium of conservation groups to try and get this program that combined traditional anti-poaching, but more to the point, tourism, what became known more as ecotourism in later years, and local education. Once that took off and became quite successful within a few years, actually people who worked with us moved across the border into Congo and set up a very complementary, quite similar project there. And a few years later, finally the last bit in Uganda was set up. And those countries traditionally, I would say during the 80s, they then collaborated quite a bit. Amy, you spent more time there in the 90s. Things are more delicate now politically.
Yeah, I think with the turmoil that took place in the 90s, the war in Rwanda and then in Congo, and now even some breakdown of the relationship between Rwanda and Uganda, who had been allies in the war in Congo, there have been periods of time here in the 90s and now into the 2000s where at least two of these nations weren't in diplomatic, had no diplomatic relationship with each other, were antagonists in wars. So although the national level officials and policies, there were tremendous barriers between the nations during some of this period of time, people on the ground in these programs and in park officers and official employees of governments continued to work together across the international boundary lines whenever possible, when war did allow it. People continued to work together, communicate. They did a lot of that, or have done a lot of that, through non-governmental organizations that provide international support and communication services. And so it's remarkable that during these 90s, when many other things were falling apart, there actually was still some concerted effort across those boundaries to work together and to help save mountain gorillas as a group.
Yeah. And in 2001, the latest census came up with a conservative number of mountain gorillas in the region of 355.
Yeah. And actually, I think they've added a few to it, so it's 359 now as a minimum count, as you said. And that reflects a lot of change, an important change. When George Schaller was studying in that same area, the same region of mountains, the same population of mountain gorillas, back in 1959, he estimated the population at between 400 and 500, so say 450. We think that's probably a pretty good baseline for the natural population size. It went down to a low of about 250 before the Mountain Gorilla Project started. And it then began a turnaround and now is up at 359 at a minimum, as you said. So even there has been a tremendous increase since the time the Mountain Gorilla Project started. It's been about 35% increase. And this is for a very slowly reproducing species. So it was all anyone could have hoped for. It was a complete turnaround. And the last 10 years, during which there has been so much war and turmoil and suffering on the part of people, 10% of that increase for the guerrilla population has taken place during those 10 very difficult years. So it's incredibly encouraging for them. But the solution for both guerrillas and people in that region is peace and economics coming back together, people finding a future for themselves as well as for the guerrillas.
Yeah. At the end of 2001, where do we stand in terms of human reconciliation?
I have always been tremendously impressed when I've been able to go back and visit Rwanda or that region, tremendously impressed by the people. Initially, right after the terrible, terrible times of genocide in Rwanda, I was back about 9 months after that had taken place for the first time after the war. And even at that time, people were saying to me very openly, we need to be able to forgive and find a way to forgive. We need to be able to look towards the future. And these were people who had seen family members killed in front of their own eyes.
Go ahead.
Ever since then, there has been, you know, each time we visit, we see again real progress being made, not without some difficulties, but a nation trying to put itself back together, a government trying to be inclusive, even though they're a minority government at this time, and economics picking back up, people beginning to restitch the social fabric of the country. But it's still, there's a long, long ways to go. People have been terribly traumatized by all of that, and it's going to take quite a bit for the politics to settle down and for people to truly feel that they can participate fully in their society and in the politics of their country.
Yeah. There's an anecdote in the book, Bill, that involves you and a member of a census team, and you were going through the jungle and the vegetation is quite low, and you're a very tall man. And you found yourself whistling or singing to yourself a very silly tune that folks will recognize the tune of. It's the Oscar Mayer song, and you found yourself, you know, if you were only, you know, wishing yourself to be much smaller, in fact, a pygmy. And that drew the interest of a member of the census team who sort of gave you his view of the world.
Yeah,
tell us that story.
Big Neme, the tracker, and we did a lot of the census together. There are a few other trackers. They're all excellent. Neme particularly liked to sing, and I've always liked to sing. And census work can get very long. There are days when you have very exciting encounters with gorillas. There are often many days in a row where you don't see any gorillas, and you're counting dung and nests and doing a lot of climbing over very difficult terrain. And so a lot of times, you know, when we weren't talking, one of us would start singing and then the other would sing. And for some reason, we were in very thick bamboo and I was bent over. We had been there for several days. My back was hurting, so I started singing, "Oh, I wish I were a little tiny mutwa. That is what I'd really like to be. And if I were a little tiny mutwa, then my back would not be killing me." And I was singing this to the tune of the Oscar Mayer Wiener song that anyone from the Midwest would know. And Nemeye heard the term mutwa, which means pygmy in Kinyarwandan, the local language. And he said, "What are you saying about pygmies?" I said, "Well, I wish I were one, because then I'd be short and I wouldn't have a sore back walking through this bamboo." And he gave me a little lecture. He gave me a kind of a stern look and then said, "No white person wants to be a pygmy." And I just let him go on, and then he said, he proceeded to give me his own historical accounting of things as from a Rwandan perspective, which was that the pygmies were definitely last in line in everything, and that since most white people were pretty well off, they must have gotten on Earth first, and they got most of the goods. Next came the Tutsi, because they had cattle, and they also had quite a bit of wealth in relative terms in Rwanda. The Hutu farmers, of which group Neme was a member, even though they were a majority in that region, came after that, and they only had land, and they had to work very hard to maintain the land, and the poor mutwa, or pygmy, came last, and that's why he had to wander around in the forest hunting his food. Most historians and anthropologists would reverse that order of arrival in the region, with certainly the pygmies coming first, the Hutu next a few thousand years ago, the Tutsi maybe a 2,000 years ago and the Europeans in the late 1800s. But it was an interesting worldview that came out of just humming a dumb little ditty in the forest.
Yeah, but eventually also he said, however, we are all Rwandans.
He also had a favorite song of his, which was, I'm a Hutu, you're a Tutsi, he's a Twa, we're all Rwandans. And he sang that repeatedly. And in discussions, he seemed to believe it. But, you know, again, through all of this, you can only see so much in another culture. Clearly, there were other things at work. And when the political situation fell apart, the economic situation fell apart, when race baiting started, we won't know if Nemeye joined in or not, or whether others joined in. But there was a brutal genocide in which the Hutu, particularly the northern Hutu, killed hundreds of thousands of Tutsi.
During your time, especially in the early days, did you see signs of the divisions between Rwandans outside of the story that Nemeye told?
We didn't see much of that. We knew that there were still some distinctions certainly being made between the three ethnic groups, but it was largely the two ethnic groups, Tutsi and Hutu, because there were very few Pygmies left in the country. But when asking people, talking about these kinds of things, they were quite open about it. And often people would say, that's somewhat of a problem, but there are other bigger problems in this country. And the bigger problems were that people living in the northwestern part of the country were favored for education, for jobs in the government, for business connections.
Development projects.
Oh, and especially development projects. That's right. So many of the aid organizations would come in and the government would direct their activities to the northwestern part of the country. And Rwandans in general were much more concerned about that than one ethnic group having privileges over another. We saw a lot of mixed ethnic group marriages. People did have to carry ID cards, but there really was very little attention paid to whether someone, you know, ever asking for an ID card that actually included what ethnic group they belonged to. So a lot of that we did not see overtly.
We did not see in the 70s and mostly throughout the 80s. I would say by the late 80s we started to see some signs of it. There's a couple incidents described in the book where people who worked with us made comments about Tutsi. Hutu employees or colleagues would make comments about Tutsi or another related ethnic group, the Bagogwe. There were reports of tensions growing in different ways. A lot of this, ironically, came about because the Western countries, the U.S. and European aid partners to Rwanda, started to insist after the Cold War ended that democratization, multi-party democratization, start in Rwanda and many other African countries. And at first, this went forward in a almost kind of lighthearted way, and certain regional parties were created and some few other parties with certain platforms, limited platforms. But after a while, again, these tensions that Amy referred to earlier, particularly the regional ones, started to come to the fore. There were angry confrontations between groups, then there were some killings. Then you had a hardcore group within several of the Hutu parties that decided, it's getting complicated here. There was an incursion by Tutsi soldiers. These were mostly the sons and grandsons of Tutsi who had been expelled at the end of the colonial period when a revolution brought the Hutu majority to power and ended several centuries of a Tutsi monarchy. Those exiles came back from Uganda. That created an ethnic tension. That's when several hardcore members of other Hutu parties broke off, started real ethnic and race baiting, and as things were falling apart for the central government, they fell into this quite easily that, well, rather than be blamed for all these problems, let's blame the old Tutsi. And that's what they did, and it finally culminated in this horrendous genocide of perhaps as many as 800,000 people being killed, hacked to death generally in a 100-day period in 1994.
Yeah, that initial invasion that Bill just mentioned took place in 1990. So for 4 years, from then until 1994, when the genocide broke out, was this very accelerated period of deterioration in the country, and political and social. And it was during those 4 years that there were major campaigns by right-wing extremist Hutus that were trying to drum up hatred against Tutsis. And so there was rapid social change during that period of time. And that was, we were not living in the country at that time, but we were visiting frequently and could see things change over that period of time. It was not what we had lived with when we lived there on a full-time basis. And it was terrifying to see happen.
Now, since then, have political and economic development projects been initiated with greater intelligence, greater sensitivity?
I wish I could say a resounding yes to that. There have initial aid to Rwanda after the cataclysm, after the genocide and new government took over. Initial aid was given only to dealing with the judicial system because there were tremendous judicial issues to deal with. Many people had been involved in committing murder and other crimes, and that included many standard citizens throughout the country, not just armed militias and military and police. And so that was a major issue. And a lot of support went into continued democratization in the country. Very little support initially went into the basic building blocks of the economy and the social structure of the country. And in fact, the new government was being held under tremendous scrutiny before basic support would be given to them for anything like health and education and agricultural needs, which they desperately needed. Everything had been destroyed. So I think things have gotten better since then. There's a more diverse portfolio of assistance projects to the country, but some things still haven't picked back up again. And it was very difficult to see these things happening when we know that our government and others gave tremendous assistance to helping with the basic human needs of people in refugee camps outside of Rwanda. And yet, initially, they weren't providing that same kind of humanitarian assistance to people in Rwanda. Again, this was right after the war, but it made no sense. And so I wish I could say that aid was much more logical and effective. I think it's getting there, but I think it went through some initial spasms where it was even more mindless than it had been earlier.
Amy Vetter and Bill Weber are our guests this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. The husband and wife team are the co-founders of the Mountain Gorilla Project. They're the authors of the new book, In the Kingdom of Gorillas, Fragile Species in a Dangerous Land. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, in 1959, as we mentioned earlier, the population of mountain gorillas was pegged at about 450. And then in 1978, the population had dropped by 200 individuals to about 250 individuals. And here's the question, you know, why kill a gorilla? Why did the population of these animals drop so precipitously, if I can get that word out, over a 20-year period?
I think when we got there, there's an awful lot of killing. We were just surrounded by dead and often, sadly, decapitated gorillas in our first year in Rwanda in 1978. And at that time, there was a very perverse market. Again, given that Rwandans did not hunt or eat gorillas, there was no local market. This was driven by foreign demand. Some individuals who thought capturing a live baby gorilla, for which the adults often had to be killed, or there were rumors of zoos and other institutes in Eastern Europe, the former Soviet bloc, trying to get gorillas. An awful lot of killing at that particular particular period of time. And the tourism project really put an end to that within a year, 18 months. There were no killings for most of the 80s in Rwanda after a real bloodbath at the end of the 70s. Before that, there had been another outbreak of killing, and that seemed to have coincided with the first Congo civil war in the mid to late 60s, after Schaller did his census and before Diane Fossey showed up. Huge areas were, the Mount Meccano area where Schaller counted 200 guerrillas, by the time I did my census in 78, there were barely 80 on the same mountain, and there was no habitat loss there. So a lot of that was killing. What we also came to realize, though, in the course of our work with that habitat loss, some of which had already occurred, probably had knocked back the guerrillas, probably had kept them from recovering from the earlier losses, and posed the single greatest threat to their future survival, because all that was left, especially on the Rwandan side, was the prime bamboo and other habitat zones that Amy had identified as the absolute essential requirement for the guerrillas to maintain themselves.
Yeah. Amy, what are the basic needs of these guerrillas?
Well, mountain guerrillas are vegetarians, largely. They eat a little bit of animal matter, but it's insects that are more opportunistic than anything else. Most of the up to 65 pounds a day that an adult male gorilla will eat, and that females will eat same kinds of food, but not quite as much, most of that is leaves and stems. And so they, in some ways, you could consider them vegetarians living in this immense salad bowl, because there's a lot of herbaceous growth on the ground of these young enough leaves and stems that they can eat, that they are willing to eat. But gorillas also are pretty selective in which of those plants that they do consume. And so they travel quite widely, and we were surprised when I did my work that I found that they ate over 100 different types of foods. And that means that in order to have a very large-bodied animal with strong nutritional requirements eating just vegetation, they do have to be picky to make sure they balance all their nutrients. And that meant they had to range somewhat widely to do that. And the group I studied most intensively ranged all the way from the top of the mountain, 12,000 feet, down to the very edge of the park, which was right there at the edge of people's farm fields. And that was about 8,800. So a large elevational gradient, lots of different foods, and that's what made us realize that we have to try to help save every bit that's left.
Yeah. Do they have preferences when it comes to mealtime?
Yeah. And in fact, that was part of my dissertation work, was to look at that. Their strongest preferences are actually for the most rare foods that they eat. And if, again, you think about trying to balance a diet with different kinds of nutritional components in different foods, the ones that are rare may have something that's different than any other, and so they might actually seek those out to complete having all the vitamins and all the minerals that they need. Hmm. And so it was interesting that one could look at their feeding patterns and say, they eat much more gallium than Dracaetia, but Dracaetia is much more rare. And when you look at how often they choose that opposed to other things, they'll choose it far more often when it is available. And so you can say they do prefer that. If they were given both of them in front of them and asked to choose one, they would always choose the Dracaetia, even though they ate much more gallium, but gallium was far more common.
What are their feelings about those nettles?
One of the things a scientist often does, not always, but often in these kinds of situations, is that you are trying to get a sense of what might be in these foods even before you can send them back for nutritional analyses. So one of the things I did was to taste them, and if a food was astringent, you know it has different kinds of chemical properties than if it's sweet or if it's, you know, have different tastes. So I tasted almost all gorilla foods that I saw consumed. I did not eat nettles, but gorillas do. And their skin is extremely tough. They can strip the leaves off a nettles plant with no apparent discomfort at all. But they do fold them up carefully and put them in their mouths. With something like thistle, which they also eat, they'll strip the leaves a little more carefully off the midrib of the stem, and then far more carefully fold those spines at the tips of the leaves into the center and then chew on it. And a thistle burr, which is extremely pointed, they'll put carefully in the back of their mouth right on these massive molars, teeth that they have, and chew back there. Those were some of the foods I didn't sample, as well as dung, and they do eat dung once in a while. I did not sample that either.
Mm. And would you tell us about their social organization?
Gorillas live in very stable family groups, and animals that are born into a family, we call it, will usually stay with that family until they become close to sexually mature, so until they're somewhere between 9 and 14 years old. And at that point, both males and females usually, and there are exceptions to these rules, more than we imagined when we first started, but usually a male or female becoming mature will leave his or her birth family. A male will go off on his own and wander as a lone silverback for some period of time, and he'll eventually try to attract females from other families to join him and start his own family. Females, when they leave their birth family, seem to almost invariably, there are very few exceptions to this, move from their birth family to join another existing family or a lone silverback. So they usually don't wander on their own. But what it means is, and females will usually not transfer too often from one family to another once they are mature. So you end up with a very strongly knit family group that youngsters are there for at least a decade, usually. Females, once they join a group, normally stay, and they get to know each other very well. One or two males stay with the group and are in charge of a number of things that happen in the family. So you have basically one or a small number of adult males with a larger group of females and all their offspring. And they know each other extremely well. They interact with each other, sometimes in mutual support, sometimes bickering back and forth, like you might find in a human family. And the youngsters grow up together, playing a tremendous amount of time. It's very much like a family setting.
One of the many moving stories in the book, In the Kingdom of Gorillas, that of the death of an 8-year-old female gorilla named Quince. This story speaks to me of the gentleness and the sensitivity and the intelligence of these animals.
Yeah. Quince was about, she's a female who was about 8.5 years old, 8 or so when I first got there, and started studying this group 5. And she's a beautiful animal. All gorillas are attractive, and they all have these very warm brown eyes. When you look into them, you know they're looking back at you with intelligence and curiosity and emotion. But anyway, Quince was one of the most beautiful. She was at the prime. She was soon to become sexually mature. She had a great life ahead of her. But she was the only animal that we knew well during our time in Rwanda that we got to know extremely well, who became ill of some what seemed to be a natural cause. We had animals die of human-related reasons, but Quince became ill, we think, from a natural cause. And it was heartbreaking to watch her over a month or more period of time become weaker. There were times when she then regained strength and then again weakened. But during this whole period of time, her family stayed with her, and they began to travel smaller distances during the day than they would have otherwise. And I think it was very clearly in order to accommodate the fact that she couldn't travel so far. And they didn't leave her. They stayed with her. They traveled shorter distances. That meant that they had less choice of foods, probably, but they managed that as a family. And when she eventually died, the family did leave her. She died during the night, and I found her on her nest site. The family was no longer there. I followed them. They had traveled north to some extent, and then they had spent the night there. Then they turned around, and the next day they made a beeline. They never retraced their own steps. They retraced their own steps immediately to where she had lain. And the research center policy was to remove bodies to see if we could do an autopsy and find out the cause of death. It was really important to know that. So she was no longer there. But the family came straight to where she had been. Two or three of the animals in the group went exactly to the spot that she had lain in, and they went, they put their heads down to the spot. They were smelling, they were looking around. They clearly came back for Quinn. And it was very moving.
Hmm. Bill, how do you recognize an individual and a group of gorillas, and how do you go about conducting a census?
I think in the kind of work situation Amy had, where she got to know this one family intimately, it's the same way you would if you're a teacher in a school. After the first couple of days, you know everybody by the combination of factors that make up their particular body type, as well as their personality, the way they act. When you're doing census work, which was much more the field work that I did in the park, you are lucky if you get to see the gorillas. Often they will flee very quietly and quickly out of sight. If you do get to see them across a ravine or maybe up in a tree, what I would try and do, what any gorilla census worker does, is to try and draw a set of lines that are above the nostrils on the gorilla, and it's called a nose print. And each gorilla has a unique combination of lines and folds and wrinkles, and we would keep those nose prints, and they've been kept now for over 30 years worth of nose prints have been kept. And every once in a while you'll find an animal that appears in one of the study groups that came from someplace else, and if we're lucky, we actually had a nose print of that individual from an earlier census or other random encounter with the gorillas.
Now, Amy, the urge to become involved in the lives of these animals is really strong.
Yeah.
But it's really important not to become intimately part of the group. Maybe you would talk with us about the difficulty and the necessity of remaining apart and the ethics of that.
Right. That was a real challenge. I think it is for anybody doing this kind of work, is that we are tremendously fortunate to be invited and accepted into the world of gorillas. They would invite, again, in these research groups where we had an intimate relationship, we were invited almost on a daily basis, and whether it was a young animal just barely touching you, and you became part of the daisy chain of all gorillas touching each other in that family during the rest session, or whether it was an older animal coming up and pounding on your back, which was clearly inviting one to play. It was, you know, you feel tremendously honored. There's a part of you that wants so much to be able to be another member of that family in some way. And yet, it became very apparent to us and important to us that we not enter their world any more than absolutely necessary. This was an honor, and it was a wonder, and one could go on with the ego ramifications of it, but their world, in order to survive, has to be allowed to be separate. It actually should be seen as sacred, as far as we're concerned, that in order for them to continue to be gorillas, to evolve in the way they should, to allow their social relationships to be maintained the way they should, we should not enter into that world. And heartbreaking though it may seem, we felt we really had to step away. The initial policy at the research center was don't respond to anything they do. So if an animal comes up and, you know, sits on your lap, you let that take place. There was a very poignant experience I had with a young gorilla whose mother had left the family and transferred to another group, who came up and wanted to shelter under my arm during a heavy rainy period. And I was tremendously honored, but I realized I could not play that role. It was wrong if I did. This gorilla would not grow up appropriately. He would be altered by my behavior if I just sat there and did nothing. And so difficult as the decision was, I felt I had to leave him. He had to find his own way in his own world, and we should allow them to have that world as much as we can unto themselves, and we should honor their invitation by walking away and doing everything we can to save them in some other fashion.
Mm. Bill, we're here at the end of time, but before we go, I want to ask you just to briefly tell us about The effort that grew out of the Mountain Gorilla Project, that the International Gorilla Conservation Project. Very quickly, what would you like to tell us about the International Gorilla Conservation Project?
Oh, simply, you know, many groups have worked in this. Our organization, the Wildlife Conservation Society, played a great role in coming up with the original ideas, initiating the Mountain Gorilla Project. It ran its course from the late 70s to late 80s. The Mountain Gorilla Project went from 260, the mountain gorilla population went from 260 up to 320. That was great. But other organizations have continued through the 90s. They've continued through very difficult political conditions. And there are many groups out there, many dedicated individuals working to save mountain gorillas. And they all can use our help, the public's help. There are also a lot of groups trying to help the Rwandan people get back on their feet. And those groups also need our help.
I want to thank the two of you very much for talking with us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Weber and Amy Vetter have been our guests this afternoon. They are the co-founders of the Mountain Gorilla Project. They've written a book about their experiences in Rwanda, in the Kingdom of Gorillas, Fragile Species in a Dangerous Land. The book is both natural history and adventure. I would recommend it. In the Kingdom of Gorillas, Fragile Species in a Dangerous Land, published by Simon and Schuster.